Now you have been provided with notes, and attached to those notes is a blank piece of paper on which you can write down notes on the further explanations and additions to the notes which I give. I would like you, if you're very keen, to take down a particular sentence or phrase to indicate. Perhaps you could stand up or just ask me. I don't mind if you interrupt me at all. It won't break down the thread of my thinking. And if you want to make a comment or ask a question during the session, well, then this would be in order. But I would only ask that your questions or comments deal with that which we're talking about. I don't want to find us going away off on extraneous subjects that have no relationship to that which we are covering in the talks. Now, there are at the back some leaflets on the table there which are free and which you can take away when you go. I think there's four different ones there, but you will see them. Now, there is a Persian proverb which says that death is a camel which lies down at every door. Which means, of course, that we are all, sometime or other, affected by death, by the loss of some loved one, somebody dear to us. And during this seminar, I would like to feel that I could help all of us to realize that death is not something to be feared. And all the evidence that there is indicates that most people are unconscious when they die, and with very few exceptions, all die peacefully, with no pain at the moment of death. And none afterwards. And then the second realization is, of course, that death in it is not an end. Death is a movement into a new life. Today, through television, radio, and books, there is being given to the public a new attitude towards death. And I hope that soon we will get away from the conventional attitude of mourning towards death and realize that death in reality is like coming in from the outside and taking off an overcoat, which is our physical body, and entering a room that is warm and comfortable and full of friendly people. You know, in the world today, hundreds of millions of Hindus believe that consciousness and subtle bodies survives death. And even the Buddhists, and there are more of them, believe that life, or karmic energy, survives death and goes on as a continuity. They believe in the wheel of births and deaths, which we call reincarnation. The ancient Greeks, the Egyptians and the Chinese all had a more enlightened view of death than that held in the Western world today. And this is something that, as I have indicated, appears to be changing very rapidly. Now, when you come to your notes, you will see that the first is a quotation from the Egyptian Book of the Dead. The soul lives after the body dies. The soul passes through the great gate and makes a way in the darkness to its source. It pierces the heart of evil to know truth and to let the soul pass on. The word darkness may be a translation, it sounds a bit strong, but the whole concept there is that there is a moving onwards from evil to truth, from the things of the material world to the essential things of the spiritual world. And the theosophical view of death is the same as that of the ancient mysteries, of the ancient Egyptians, and the Egyptian mysteries, of course. The soul lives after the body dies. Also in the Egyptian Book of the Dead, we find this. Earth hath my body, heaven hath my soul. And there was an understanding of the difference, the essential difference in the concepts revealed in that Egyptian Book of the Dead. Now, the theosophical attitude towards death begins with the concept that all life emerges from the higher region of consciousness, which we can term spiritual. That is the beginning of life. Man's higher principles, which compose his spiritual nature, are of greater reality than his transitory physical body, and they therefore survive the physical body. And because this is the opposite to that which we hold in everyday life, to follow through what I'm going to say tonight, we'll have to put aside our normal everyday thought and try and look at it from the higher faculty, from the point of view of the spiritual faculty, look downwards, as it were, to understand the physical world. Now, in your notes, next, at death, man's spiritual nature or soul is withdrawn from its transitory physical body, taking with it the thought-feeling aspects of his personality consciousness, which survive in full awareness and with memory of the experiences of the life just finished. I'm making these the sort of preliminary statements of the theosophical point of view, and all of these will be discussed more fully as we go on. But I would like to make the point, in addition to that which is here in your notes, that the well-known human being with the same life interests, character, and human peculiarities lives on until in the course of time, the essential nature of his life's experiences, the positive qualities of love and understanding, are sifted from the unessential and are merged with the stream of consciousness, which is his immortal spiritual self. In other words, the man after death is the same as he was before death, but there is a process of sifting out that which is important in his experience, until all that is essential goes back to the immortal spiritual self. I had from a book a note by a biologist, and I've cut this down because it wasn't very easy to follow, although they said this was in clear biological language. But this is an opinion of somebody not a theosophist, a scientist, a biologist. The center of consciousness, which was in existence before death, does not cease to be in existence after death. It goes on. And there is a continuity between the two, that which existed before and that which existed after. And he suggests that it is like a man who sleeps for a while and wakes again. He has continuity of consciousness. He remembers what he was doing the day before he went to sleep. There is continuity of consciousness from one day to another, although there may not be continuity of consciousness, or does not appear to be continuity of consciousness during sleep. Now, we've reached the point where we're coming into the sort, as it were, the basis of what we're going to talk about tonight. Several popular books have been recently published by medical researchers, and they report the testimony of patients who have suffered what is called clinical death, or sometimes medical death. That is, they've been declared medically dead but have been revived by the use of sophisticated medical skills available only in recent years. I don't propose to go into those skills in particular. Some of them, of course, in some cases, they actually use a shock treatment. And one case, the woman remembers, she was watching her body and she remembers her body jumping off the bed when it got shock treatment, but it brought her back to life. In one of these books, called The Art of Dying, and there's a copy in the book depot up above, the author, Ian Crichton, quotes the experience of Peter Sellers, the film star, who in 1969 had a massive heart attack and nearly died. And what's happening today is that these people are coming forward and giving their experiences, and they're being recorded by these medical researchers. He said, "I felt as if I was dozing off and then waking up. But each time I had slept, I had in fact died. My heart had stopped. I didn't feel as if I were dying. If that is what dying is like, then I shan't worry about it again." Peter Sellers. And seeing he's shown, as he always does, of course, a light-hearted attitude towards things, I thought perhaps I could quote you a story from the same book, which the author says came from New Zealand. A bereaved relative telephoned the florist and said, "The ribbon must be extra wide with 'rest in peace' on both sides, and if there is room, we shall meet in heaven." The florist was away, and one of her assistants took the order, and there was consternation when the flowers were delivered. The ribbon was extra wide, and on it was the inscription, "Rest in peace on both sides, and if there is room, we shall meet in heaven." Now, in Crichton's book, there again is the case of the American, which is in your notes. An American woke up saying, "Why did you bring me back, Doc? It was so nice here." And the first point is that all researchers testify that the nearly dead, in all cases, when they were revived, said they did not want to come back to the physical world. They found themselves in an otherworldly paradise from which they did not want to return. And this is very interesting. And this is in our theosophical books and many other books on the subject of death. The conditions after death are immeasurably better in all ways than they are during life. The best book, I think, is probably, your notes again, Life After Life by Dr. Raymond Moody, whose developing interest led him to lecture on human survival of biological death. From the direct contact with students and others, he gathered 150 reports of near-death experiences and found that in spite of a wide variation in circumstances surrounding the close calls with death, and the type of person undergoing them, because those are the two variable factors, there was a striking similarity among the accounts of the experiences themselves. And he found another interesting thing. His classes were usually about 30 students, and when he lectured on death from a medical point of view and raised this question of after-death experiences, one at least, and often more, students came up to him afterwards and said that they had been involved in near-death experiences, or they knew people who had experienced this themselves. He found this interesting, amazing. And today, as these books are being written, more and more people are coming forward with experiences. There was one on the radio in Auckland, John Munster. Did you hear it? He's writing a book about it. And his comments are, I've got some of them on notes, are in line with those which Dr. Moody has enumerated. Now, Dr. Moody, from these experiences that were related to him, set out the following brief ideal experience which embodies all common elements. And if you turn to page 2, you will see these listed. I will read them through, but I won't comment on them at this stage, because later we will come back and we will go through each one. Number 1. A man is dying, and as he reaches the point of greatest physical distress, he hears himself pronounced dead by his doctor. Secondly, he now begins to hear a ringing or buzzing noise and feels himself moving rapidly through a long dark tunnel. And 3, after this he suddenly finds himself outside his own body, and watching from a distance the resuscitation attempts which are being taking place in the hospital. He notices he still has a body, but one of a very different nature and with very different powers from those of the physical body he has left behind. 4, soon others come to meet and help him. He glimpses the spirits of relatives and friends who have died. And 5, a loving, warm spirit, what he calls, and many of those who gave evidence did call, a being of light, appears before him. This being asks him a question, non-verbally, words were not used, to make him evaluate his life. And, next, I've made it 6, helps him along by showing him an instantaneous playback of the major events of his life. And this, in most books, is called the review. And 7, at some point, he meets a barrier representing the limit between earthly life and the next. And when he finds he must go back, he resists. For by now, he is taken up with his experiences in the afterlife and does not want to return. And as I've said, practically all the experiences that have been investigated by these medical people say the same thing. They did not want to return. 8, he is overwhelmed with feelings of joy, love, and peace. 9, despite everything, he somehow reunites with his physical body and lives. And 10, later when he tries to tell others, he can find no words adequate to express or describe these unearthly episodes. The difficulty of describing that is something which is beyond human everyday physical experience. Now, all 10 points show many similarities to the theosophical concept of the process of dying. And in this and the next session, each point will be discussed and compared with extracts from the following books, all of which are available in the book depot or from the library upstairs. Life After Death by C.W. Leadbeater, Through the Gateway of Death by Geoffrey Hodgson, Transition by Charles Hampton, Through Death to Rebirth by James Perkins, and another small one which I haven't got down here, you could make a note of, There Is No Death by Clara Codd. It's an inexpensive book, but it's very good. There Is No Death by Clara Codd. Now, the first two authors, that's C.W. Leadbeater and Geoffrey Hodgson, are clairvoyants in their own right. James Perkins had a near-death experience, which he describes in that book, and which fits to a very large extent the pattern of experience that we've talked about. Charles Hampton writes more from a churchman's point of view, but some of his points are very, very clearly shown, very clearly made. Confirmation of these concepts is also to be found in the Tibetan and the Egyptian books of the dead. The Egyptian and the Tibetan books of the dead, and I'll quote some of those. Some spiritualistic books are very good indeed. Some are not so good. And Dr. Raymond Moody quotes also Swedenborg and Plato. And there are many other writers, like Edgar Cayce, for instance, who describe the same sort of conditions that we are talking about after death. Now, is there anything anybody would like to say at this point? This is just our preliminary. We've now got to get into the meat of the subject. The first comment is on the greatest physical distress, which is part of number one, the man is dying. To quote Mr. Perkins, the approach to death often is painful, but with its arrival, pain ceases. And unless there is some unusual reason for it, fear is not present. So at death, there is no pain, and with very, very few exceptions, there appears to be no fear. In the Hampton book, failure of respiration brings very little pain because the carbon dioxide acts as an anesthetic. This is when the lungs are not, when the breathing is failing. As long as a vital organ struggles to survive, there is pain, but that pain gradually fades and finally ceases. And Geoffrey Hodgson puts it this way, the failure of the supply of blood and so of oxygen to the brain brings on unconsciousness, a process which is just like falling asleep. Even if there has been suffering at the near approach of death, that suffering ceases before the end. And another researcher, this time not a theosophist, he is the director of the American Society of Psychical Research, Dr. Osis, O-S-I-S. And he speaks for all modern medical researchers when he says, regardless of vast differences in religion, nationality, and culture, the experiences of the dying show that it is a basically happy, peaceful, and even beautiful experience. That's a very strong statement coming from somebody who's a researcher, a psychological researcher, I think, in this case, into the death state. So now, let us pass on to the moment of death. Medical definition, a medical definition of the moment of death, is very difficult to establish, says Lyle Watson in the Romeo era. Are there any doctors, nurses here tonight who would like to speak to this? What actually is the moment of death from a medical point of view? Well, it's a breakdown of an organ, usually the heart, but it could be of the breathing, suffocation, or it could be when the brain ceases to function. And evidence is that the last organ to cease to function is the brain. And that probably is as near as you can get to a medical definition. It's when the brain ceases to function. Now, have I not got any nurses here? to take me up on this. Yes? This is quite correct. But now I'll read you something from the this book, Romeo Error, by La Watson. In November the 3rd, 1967, a wounded United States soldier in the best military hospital in Vietnam was taken to the mortuary after 45 minutes had been spent in resuscitation attempts. And the doctors and the two important machines, the electrocardiograph, which measures the activity of the heart, and the electroencephalograph, which measures the brain waves, the activity of the brain waves, both those indicated that death had taken place. All said he was dead. But 4 hours later, he recovered in the mortuary. So you see, it's in some cases there isn't that moment of death that can be recognized medically. And before we get to the end of tonight's session, I will tell you what I think from a theosophical point of view is the moment of death. But one thing they all agree upon is that death has finally taken place when decomposition of the body begins. But of course you have to wait for this to happen. When it does happen, the coordinating centers all over the body, which enforce genetic instructions, instructions of growth, have ceased to function, and the cells are left to go their own individual way without an organizing pattern. And you could put this sentence down because it's very, very important. Biologists are today realizing that the distinction, biologists are today realizing that the distinction between the living and the dead, biologists today are realizing that the distinction between the living and the dead is based on the presence or absence of a coordinating pattern. Is based on the presence or absence of a coordinating pattern. And when that, based on the presence or absence of a coordinating pattern, if you like, a life energy field or a vital body. A life energy field or a vital body.
Could you repeat again on the presence?
Life energy field or a vital body. Now, have you all got that? Well, what happens, of course, when this life energy field, this coordinating field, this pattern is lost, then the cells go their own way. And their life carries on, but it's a life of decay or decomposition. That happens in a plant world. When you make a compost heap, that's exactly what you're doing. The pattern, life pattern of the plant is gone, and it goes more slowly than the human body. And the cells break up and they go their own way. And this, of course, is what happens during cancer, but we won't go into that tonight. Would anybody like to comment about that? The life energy field, of course, is that, probably that, which is called the etheric double and which can be seen in the Kierlian photographs, which many of you will have seen. Now, let us go to the next one. Ringing or buzzing noises. Now, Mr. Hodgson, from his own experience, describes the moment of death. We shall see the life forces of the body being withdrawn from the extremities, the arms and legs, and centered in the heart, there to be visible as glowing golden light. Then as death draws nearer, the life forces are withdrawn still further into the middle of the head, into the third ventricle of the brain, the seat of the spiritual self in physical life. Would you like to take that down? It's in the third ventricle of the brain, into the middle of the head, the third ventricle of the brain, V-E-N-T-R-I-C-L-E, of the brain, the seat of the spiritual self in physical life. They are withdrawn into the middle of the head, the third ventricle of the brain, the seat of the spiritual self in physical life. Now that's the end of Mr. Hodgson's quote, or the quote from Mr. Hodgson's book. When, and this is my own way of putting it, but I know that this is in literature in many places, when the life force is entirely centered in the brain, it finally leaves as a shaft of golden light through the top of the head. You could add to what you've already got, but don't quote, it's not quoting Mr. Hodgson. It finally leaves as a shaft of golden light through the top of the head. It finally leaves as a shaft of golden light through the top of the head. Now, have you all got that? There have been recorded instances where the yogis of India, who are able to gather up this electromagnetic energy to a very great extent, suddenly explode it through the top of the head and break the sutures. You know that the bones of the head are interlocked. You're a nurse, you'll know how the sutures are. The bones interlock like this, and they're broken wide open, and the energy goes straight out. And in the case of a yogi, the death process is extremely rapid. Now, it's not in our theosophical literature, we don't have, as far as I know, any real instances of this buzzing and ringing. But I think it's probably the withdrawal of the vital energy field, the etheric, which of course is the nervous system, into the brain, the last organ to die, which causes what Dr. Moody's patients called a buzzing or a ringing, sometimes pleasant and sometimes not. Now, it is said that the electromagnetic charges, and of course our nervous system is electromagnetic charges, that's why the electroencephalograph can measure what's going on, the pulses inside the brain with it from its terminals, and it shows on the needle. But it seems that the amount of energy in the brain is increased 10 times just at the moment of death. And I myself feel it's this increase of the electromagnetic potential in the brain that causes these buzzing and ringing sounds. Anybody like to comment on that? Strange to say, in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, there is a reference to these noises. The soul of the dying person departs from the body and finds himself in a void. Notice the word void, we'll talk about it later. He may hear alarming sounds describing as roaring, thundering, or whistling noises like the wind. And then it goes on. He is surprised to find himself out of his body. He sees and hears his relatives and friends mourning over his body and preparing it for the funeral. But when he tries to respond to them, they neither see nor hear him. And the next week we'll cover this whole ground of why they can neither see nor hear him, but he can be aware of them. So the Tibetan Book of the Dead seems to suggest that we do experience these noises. Now let us go to number 6 on your notes of clinical death. This is an instantaneous playback of the major events of his life. The review, sometimes called a microfilmed history of one's life. Now, there are the letters that were written by the Mahatmas the Masters of the Wisdom to A.P. Sinnott through Madame Blavatsky in the very early days of this society. These letters are still in the British Museum, and they were published in A.T. Barker's book called The Mahatma Letters to A.P. Sinnott. Now, I am not setting forward any opinion about these letters, but I am going to quote from the review as it is set out in one of these letters. I'm going to quote one of these letters describing the review. Between the last throbbing of the heart and the moment when the last spark of animal heat leaves the body, the brain thinks, and the spiritual self lives over in a few brief seconds his whole life. Speak in whispers, ye who assist at the deathbed, and find yourselves in the solemn presence of death, lest you disturb the quiet ripple of thought and hinder the busy work of the past, casting its reflection upon the veil of the future. A very beautiful way of putting it. Be quiet in the last moment when a person is dying, so that you do not stop this process of review, which is the past casting its reflection upon the veil of the future. As in a dream, the events of a long life, to the minutest detail, are marshaled in greatest order in a few seconds in our vision. And the last thoughts that pass through the brain at this time become the fashioner of our bliss or woe, the life principle of our future existence. Very, very beautifully put. Now, Mr. Hodgson, in his book, puts it this way. Because of this review at death, we should be physically quiet in the chamber of death, lest by an excess of grief we disturb the loved one in this important process. And he's talking about the review. He is now living in his subtler body and is highly sensitive to thought and emotion. Calmly and with self-control, our thoughts should be turned in love towards him in blessing for his progress inwards to those inner worlds. I don't think you need to take notes. Is there any part that you'd like to? Perhaps I could quote Clara Codd, which is probably puts it also very clearly. In the deeper parts of ourselves, nothing is ever forgotten. And as a man passes to life on the other side, he seems to pass quickly through the halls of his own memory. It is as if leaving the arena of life, man looks back and in a bird's eye view sees his life as a whole, where he has succeeded and where he has failed. I'd like to take just a little of that down. Probably the easiest one. Now, I was interested to see in Lyle Watson's book and in others that many people who have a near-death experience have this. One of them was described by Lyle Watson as a mountaineer who fell from a very high point down thousands of feet, but landed in a snowdrift and lived. And during that fall, he remembered absolutely that during that fall, the whole of his life was played before his eyes. And of course, he was probably unconscious for a while after he hit the snowdrift, but afterwards he remembered. So there is evidence that this happens at the very moment of death. However, most of Dr. Moody's informants describe this. They call it as memory, but extraordinarily rapid memory. And they said that everything appeared at once, yet the review was incredibly vivid, and the whole of the individual's life was shown in detail. But he infers that this happened later in what I call the dying sequence. It didn't happen exactly at the moment of death. It happened later where they met the being of light. And I can't talk about the being of light tonight. It will have to be talked about next week. But the review is described in exactly the same way as it is in Theosophical literature and many other books. But in Dr. Moody's case, it appears to be later in the time sequence. And yet, you see, I'm talking about this mountaineer, which is another case by La Watson, where it happened instantaneously, actually before death, before the moment of death. And this is what drowning people actually say sometimes too, that their whole life flashes before them at the moment of dying. So everything appears to show that there are variations in the death experiences of different people. And we have to be careful not to be dogmatic about the whole subject. Yes? Now, I think that it was probably very, very, as Maya said, probably very, very fast, very rapid. And he may not have remembered it, yes? It could be that he didn't remember it.
It could be.
Well, now I'd like to pass on to the next one, which is E, which is number 3. He finally... I've got this marked wrong. This is the long dark tunnel. And when Mr. Hodson lectured last week, he picked me up on that. The long dark tunnel is the term used by Dr. Moody, but it isn't necessarily a long dark tunnel. And as I read on, you'll see I probably should have called it the dark tunnel. Remember the Tibetans called it the void. Now let me read on. Dr. Moody's informants described a feeling of being pulled rapidly through a dark space of some kind, a cave, a tunnel, or a valley. And the word used in the Tibetan Book of the Dead was a void. And this is one of the descriptions from Dr. Moody. Suddenly I was in a very dark, very deep valley. It was as though there was a pathway, almost a road, through the valley, and I was going down the path. Later, after I was well, the thought came to me. Now I know what the Bible means by the valley of the shadow of death. Well, I just put the idea before you. That's what it could mean. Now, Clara Codd explains this as a symbolic memory of the period of unconsciousness immediately following death. You can put that down if you like. A period of unconsciousness following death. It's quite true that if there are some cases, as I said about the Indian yogi, he went straight like that, straight to a higher level of consciousness. And he would have no review. He'd have no period of unconsciousness. But many of these people did. Now, Clara Codd puts it this way. Then as the soul leaves the body, the consciousness for a short time passes into a deep sleep, during which the psychic body, which during life permeates and surrounded the physical body, is adjusted to an independent existence upon the other side. In other words, any period of unconsciousness is a refocusing, forming a new focus for consciousness. And we'll talk about this in the later sessions, but if you get that idea, that to refocus the consciousness in a new plane of existence, there is necessarily, or nearly always necessarily, a period of unconsciousness. Sometimes very short, but sometimes quite long. Now, the length of the period of unconsciousness varies with the individual circumstances. But, and I think I'm quoting Mr. Hodson there, usually assessed as 36 to 48 hours. Now, there appear to be 1, 2, 3 deaths And there again, there is not always the same. Some people don't have the second and so on. So perhaps I better go back to this later. But Hampton in the book Transition says, some remain unconscious anywhere from a few hours to a few days or even weeks in the case of a person who firmly believes death means annihilation of consciousness. If a person dies believing that death means annihilation of consciousness, then exactly that happens, and it takes them weeks to wake up from this period of unconsciousness, and they have to be helped in many cases by others. But many are immediately awake the minute they are dead. But again, you see, you haven't any, you've got all sorts of different conditions. And they are far more awake than they ever were in physical life. Quoting Hampton. Now we should go on to E, which is 3. After this, he suddenly finds himself outside his own body and watching from a distance resuscitation attempts. Dr. Moody and many other investigators cite cases of accident victims and persons under anesthetic being awake almost immediately. Here's one accident case. There was that awful sound, the side of a car being crushed in. I hope not many of you have heard that sound. And there was just an instant in which I seemed to be going through darkness, an enclosed space. And it was very quick. It wasn't a long dark tunnel. It was a very, very short tunnel. But there was that experience of darkness. Then I was sort of floating. It's a very graphic description. I was sort of floating above the street, not far from the car. I saw people come crowding round, and I saw my friend get out of the car, and I could see my own body in the wreckage. And in another case of Dr. Moody's, the people passed actually through him. He was standing outside away from the car, and people came hurrying up to see what had happened, went right through him. You see? Again, we'll talk about that next time. Now, the soul who dies a more natural death, not an accidental death, not a sudden death, will gradually awake to a restful world of shining light. And again, we'll talk about this next week. And Mr. C.W. Leadbeater says that a Western man who is not accustomed to the idea of life carrying on after death, and who has in his mind annihilation or going to heaven or to hell, he may find it difficult to believe that he is dead simply because he still sees and hears and thinks and feels. And many investigators have said that the person after death finds it very difficult to believe that they are dead because they are the same person, the same thoughts and feelings, but it's their limitations, not being able to contact people on the earth. It's those limitations that give them an understanding of the fact that they are dead. And in number F, which is number 4, every one of these informants said there was always a welcome on the other side. And Mr. C.W. Leadbeater says, presently the man will meet with some other dead person who has been more sensibly instructed and will learn from him that there is no cause for fear and that there is a rational life to be lived in this new world, just as there was in the old one. And Dr. Moody confirms that his informers remembered being met and helped, which of course is number 4 in your list. And G, the return to physical life, which is number 9 on your list. Some recall being drawn rapidly back through the dark tunnel, but most report that they simply went to sleep or lapsed into unconsciousness to awaken later in life. But we'll talk about that more next week. Now, Would you like, there's a little more here tonight, but I can leave it to next week. We've probably had our hour. But one thing I perhaps could explain, and we'll go over it again next week, is that from the theosophical point of view, death actually takes place when the link between the physical and the superphysical bodies is broken. Now, when the person is above their body, in what's sometimes called a spiritual body, looking down at their own body, they in many cases see that they are linked by a silver cord. That silver cord normally goes to the head. There may even be two. Some people say one of them goes to the solar plexus. But it is through that cord that the withdrawal ultimately takes place. The life energy goes through that cord and up into the superphysical bodies. And at one stage, the cord is cut, the cord is broken. And when that happens, there is no possibility of consciousness returning to the physical body. And that, from a theosophical point of view, is the point of death. And it coincides largely to the time when the life energies leave the brain. So what we said before is probably true, that the nearest you can get to medical death is when the brain becomes inactive, when the energy, the electromagnetic energies, leave the brain.